The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There are historical linkages, right, certainly for France and the UK, but there are also strong economic ties. And I think it also speaks and connects back to this question of the rules-based order, right? If you have actors who, regardless of where they are located, are jeopardizing that order, then some would argue that NATO should take a position on that. And if you look at the preamble of the Washington Treaty, right, the language is quite clear, and this is why the alliance is often called a political and military alliance, right? Because it is meant to uphold the principles of the rule of law and support for democracy.
I'm Matt Gluck, research fellow at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, April 19th, 2024. NATO recently had its 75th birthday, and many say its trajectory traces the adage, the more things change, the more they stay the same. That is, at least in some ways, NATO has returned to its original mission of collective self-defense. This means the alliance is concentrating less on out-of-area operations that have occupied much of its focus since the end of the Cold War. The transition comes at a time when many are questioning the U.S.'s long-term commitment to its NATO allies, especially in light of former President Trump's recent comments about burden-sharing within the alliance. I discuss NATO's current and likely future posture with Sara Moeller, Associate Teaching Professor in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. We spoke about NATO's role in the war in Ukraine, the alliance's focus in the Indo-Pacific, and how NATO is balancing arms control with maintaining strong nuclear deterrence. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 19th. Sara Moeller on NATO at 75. Sara, could you start us off by broadly describing the history of NATO? What's happened over the last 75 years to bring us to today?
How long is this podcast, Matt? No, of course. Well, let me start by touching on a theme that has emerged lately within the alliance, which is this idea that NATO has returned to its core mission of collective defense, where it began. And then I can talk sort of full circle where the alliance went in the post-Cold War period and where I think it's headed right now. But in a very real sense, the alliance is currently undergoing a major transformation, certainly on the military side of the house. And it's in the process of trying to prove the old adage, you can't go home again, wrong. Now, whether it will ultimately pull it off is very much an open question, but it is certainly trying to do so. And what do I mean by that? Well, for the first 40, 45 years of its existence, NATO had one core task, collective defense. It was very much like a shop that exclusively sold one product. However, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Warsaw Pact, significantly altered the geopolitical landscape, and it enabled NATO to take on new roles and responsibilities beyond that traditional defense focus. And so in the 1990s, NATO ended up doing that and adopting two core tasks in addition to its traditional collective defense core task. These were crisis prevention and management and cooperative security. And this wasn't just a rhetorical shift within the alliance. It wasn't just something that was written into the alliance's strategic concepts, the main document that the alliance uses to define its role for itself. this shift had real operational consequences, not just for the alliance's military structures, but also, I would argue, for the nation's armed forces themselves. And so, beginning with the enforcement of a no-fly zone in the Balkans in 1992, which 3 years later was followed by a two-week aerial bombing campaign that NATO undertook against Bosnian Serb forces, NATO participated in several what have since been called either non-Article 5 crisis management operations, or you may sometimes come across the term out-of-area expeditionary missions and operations. And these were missions and operations in places like Kosovo, North Macedonia, of course, Afghanistan, the Mediterranean, and Libya. But the point is that none of those missions and operations were about collective defense per se, the original raison d'etre of the alliance. It was about projecting security rather than deterring and defending against immediate direct threats to alliance territory. Now, one could argue, and many did at the time, that instability elsewhere posed an indirect threat to the alliance. But the point is that none of those missions I just mentioned, even Afghanistan, were about safeguarding alliance territory itself or the people who reside there. And that post-Cold War shift in focus towards these out-of-area expeditionary missions and the belief that drove it, the belief that continental defense was a thing of the past, led many, if not most, allied governments to radically overhaul their armed force postures. They cut back on the capabilities and size of their formations that were required for traditional territorial defense missions during the Cold War, and instead chose to focus and reorient their armed forces around leaner expeditionary units. Now, fast forward to Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, which was a wake-up for some within the alliance, but not everyone. NATO did take certain steps in response, most famously creating four multinational battle groups for the East. But really, individually, aside from the Eastern flank allies, most allies didn't shift course and were still very much proceeding with the post-Cold War business-as-usual mindset. And there were at the time, however, some officials in the alliance who were concerned that the alliance's strategic guidance was woefully out of date. And what they began doing was quietly behind the scenes working on new strategic guidance. And so in 2020, the alliance adopts a new strategic framework called the Concept for the Deterrence and Defense of the Euro-Atlantic Area, or DDA for short, which represents a real break in how alliance officials are thinking about NATO's role. And as its name suggests, it's about returning to this original mission of deterrence and defense. Now, the DDA is a multi-year, multi-pronged strategic level framework that calls for significant changes to how the alliance does business in both crisis time and wartime. And there are several features that we can talk about if you're interested. The regional defense plans, which have gotten a lot of attention, reforms to the NATO force posture, a new alert system, new authorities for SACCUR, updated command and control, and greater emphasis on exercises. But I think the key point to note here is that even though the alliance had put the DDA into form in 2020, even though it had this framework for adaptation in place, it's not until Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022 that a lot of the individual elements and pieces start being put into motion. So, for example, at the Madrid summit in 2022, you get the announcement about the new NATO force model, which is supposed to scale up to 300,000 high readiness forces. And the following year at the Vilnius summit, last year in 2023, you get the DDA family of collective defense plans being officially approved by the heads of government. So to sum up, there's been significant groundwork laid behind the scenes in the last three or so years, and there's a detailed roadmap that's now in place. The intention is there for NATO to return to its traditional mission, core task of collective defense, deterrence and defense of the Atlantic community. What remains an open question is whether the allies possess the political resolve and the fiscal capacity really to enact the necessary changes. So there's a fascinating, exciting military transformation underway in NATO right now, but whether it actually gets executed and implemented will ultimately hinge not so much on what the NATO headquarters are are doing, but more on what individual allies are contributing and whether they are able to make the investments and reform their national armed forces to turn NATO intentions into reality.
It's an excellent summary. Thank you for that. So there's been some question, especially in light of a potential second Trump administration, about the future of the alliance with respect to the relationship between the United States and its European allies. Could you give us a sense of how European leaders are thinking about the alliance broadly in this kind of new era of U.S. policy?
Sure. So obviously, it goes without saying that in an alliance of 32, you're going to see a range of views, right? Everything from one end of the spectrum, you have someone like Hungary's Orbán, who has a close relationship to President Trump and therefore would probably be happy to see him be reelected in November. But there are other allies, and I would say this is probably a majority view within the alliance right now, who are worried about a possible Trump 2.0, the return of President Trump. Now, having said that, I think the problem that the Euro-Atlantic relationship, the transatlantic security relationship faces at this moment is bigger than just Trump, right? Because as we're seeing in real time, and certainly at the time of this recording, Congress has not yet passed the supplemental aid bill for Ukraine, right? The shift that is happening in U.S. domestic politics, the turn towards isolationism, some have called it, but certainly a different view about America's role in the world, and in particular, America's role in Europe and European defense and security, right? It's wider than just one individual. So there have been some reports in the last couple of weeks about proposals to try to Trump-proof the alliance. Personally, I'm not sure if that is possible, only because the alliance, by design, remains heavily wedded to the views, positions, and capabilities of the United States, right? Whether it's the military commander, Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, who by tradition is always an American, right? Or if it's Allied Command Operations, the headquarters that is responsible for planning NATO operations or conducting NATO operations, I should say instead. These are institutions, features of the NATO military command structure and architecture that are, by and large, have a strong U.S. presence and influence, to say nothing of the ultimate guarantee of European security, which is, of course, the U.S. nuclear deterrent. So, the allies are worried about this, but my advice, certainly, when Europeans come through town is, I think it would be a mistake to frame this around one person and one outcome in November. As we're seeing on the Hill right now, there is a split in U.S. politics occurring regarding what the role of the U.S. should be in Europe. So to my mind, at least, this will continue, this discussion and this debate will continue after November, even if Trump loses the election.
In a conversation with Stephen Wertheim and Alan Rosenstein on the Lawfare podcast in 2021 about NATO and the future of NATO, obviously a very different time from our current moment, you said that Trump's approach to NATO was largely a rhetorical and tonal difference from U.S. policy with respect to NATO in the past. Do you still view it that way?
The first term, yes, right? I still see that I still see a case that can be made, and I was making the case then, and I think I would feel comfortable making the case today as well, that during the Trump administration, you have to distinguish between what the president was saying, which was inflammatory rhetoric, and what those who staffed him were doing behind the scenes, right? So what do I mean by that? Well, you see that if you look at the U.S. force posture contributions to Europe during the first Trump administration, you see the number of U.S. personnel increase. it changes slightly towards the very end, but by and large, there's an increase, partly because the U.S. Army 5th Corps is reestablished in Poland, but there are some other things driving it. You also see that U.S. military assistance through the European Reassurance Later Deterrence Initiative, EDI, actually increases. So there are a number of metrics that things look better than what we were hearing, right? But I think that there's every indication that just because that was true during his first term, if he was reelected, that is unlikely, I would say at this point, to be repeated. Because the people who were around him, whether it's Mattis as SecDef or Kelly and others, right? These were, I think, transatlanticists. These were people who believed in NATO. And from everything that I've seen reported, Trump is unlikely to bring that caliber of policymaker into a second administration. And so some have called it, you know, the safeguards, the rails that were there. I think that that would be gone in a second administration. So I would be less confident predicting a repeat of the first administration's policies.
Okay. I now want to turn to the most salient issue facing NATO right now, which is the war in Ukraine. In 2021, in that Lawfare podcast episode, Stephen Wertheim made the argument, and some have made this argument since the invasion, perhaps most prominently John Mearsheimer, that NATO expansion caused Russia to invade Ukraine and launch its full-scale war. So what do you think of the merits of that argument, and what would you say to people who make it?
I think that as most things in life, it's complicated, right? I'm not a firm believer in single causes of anything. I think the real world is complicated and multi-causal. So I am more comfortable saying that NATO's expansion is one of several factors that certainly the Putin administration, right, the Putin regime points to try and justify, not that there is any justification for the absolutely brutal and unprovoked war against Ukraine and the atrocities that we are seeing on a daily basis there. But from a clearly academic IR theory realist perspective, right, I think that one could argue that not just NATO expansion, EU expansion, right, that clearly for Putin's vision, right, of a greater Russia, that presented a challenge to him, right? He has a very clear roadmap for what he would like to see happen in his lifetime, right? He believes and has called, I think, the end of the Cold War the biggest strategic failure or disaster in the 20th century, right? So this is someone who wants to restore what for him was Russia's greatness. And so when he is confronted with the other guys taking steps that to him, right, reinforce the sense that his team lost, right? Because NATO and the EU are have an open door policy, right? These are associations that welcome other countries, and you don't see anyone clamoring, as far as I know, to join Putin's Russia, right? So I think he finds it rhetorically a challenge, and perhaps also strategically a challenge for reconstituting his vision of the Soviet Empire.
How would you characterize NATO's role in the war in Ukraine? It obviously frames itself as a defensive alliance, but how specifically would you say NATO has been involved during the war?
Right. So here I think it's important to distinguish between NATO as an alliance, an organization, and NATO allies, because I think that's sometimes lost in the wider public. And frankly, also that Moscow has been able to take advantage from a disinformation campaign and portray itself as being opposed to, or rather fighting, all of NATO to its own audience, right? So a domestic audience. So yes, NATO is a defensive alliance. NATO is not, as Secretary General Stoltenberg reminds the media on a, I think, weekly basis at this point, NATO is not a party to the war in Ukraine. NATO allies bilaterally and in some cases multilaterally have been supporting Ukraine with military assistance and aid, with training, with logistics, with arms transfers. But in terms of what NATO, big NATO, the organization that itself has done, it's been largely confined to humanitarian aid, some information sharing, and then the most recent development we saw announced at a spring ministerial this year was the establishment of a joint training and evaluation center, the JTEC, in Bydgoszcz, Poland, which is an opportunity for big NATO and NATO military structures and officials to learn some of the important lessons that Ukrainians are learning on a daily basis in their opposition to Russian military forces. But I think it is important to distinguish between what NATO allies are doing and what NATO as an organization is doing in terms of providing assistance. There have been important rhetorical support as well on the part of NATO leaders, and I think that has played a role. But to date, most of the military assistance, certainly all of the technical assistance, the military components, has been provided bilaterally outside of NATO.
What is the alliance doing to increase its interoperability? A panelist at the Georgetown conference, though that was excellent, and that you ran, mentioned that certain 155 millimeter artillery shells are sufficiently different among the allies that they can't be transferred and used across the alliance. So what is NATO doing to address this issue and similar preparedness and resilience weaknesses?
Well, short answer is not enough. The longer answer is that this, and this being the standardization interoperability challenges within the alliance, has been a long-standing concern. And I'm old enough to remember anecdotes, not just from the Bosnia and Afghanistan campaigns, but also from Libya. And it's beyond ammunition and hardware, right? It goes to also the question of, or connects rather to the question of information sharing, CIS, the ability to talk to each other in real time, right, through NATO channels as opposed to national channels. It is a longstanding concern of the alliance. A couple years back, almost a decade or so, I would say at this point, NATO had an ambitious effort labeled Smart Defense that was supposed to address exactly this set of issues. Unfortunately, that effort seems to have fallen off the radar, and we now find ourselves in this new security landscape, having to start really from where we began many, many years ago. So it's a big challenge for the alliance. People are aware of it. People are trying to fix it. But it connects back to something else that the leaders will be discussing at the upcoming July Washington summit, which is defense industrial production, right? How do you ensure that the alliance bilaterally, allies at least, can support Ukraine's ammunition and other defense needs and build up our own national stockpiles as well, given that the defense industrial base in Europe is not where it needs to be for those ambitions.
Last week, we had some breaking news about NATO's involvement in the war in Ukraine. Could you explain what happened and what the implications of it could be?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, there is this important distinction between what NATO as an organization and individual NATO allies have been doing to support Ukraine. But we are seeing in real time that this line could be shifting or becoming more blurred. At the foreign ministerial last week, April 3rd and April 4th in Brussels, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg announced that there was now consensus among the allies to move ahead with thinking about creating a possible framework for NATO as an organization to take over what is informally called the Ramstein Group, but is more formally known as the Ukrainian Defense Contact Group, which is this U.S.-led initiative of some, I think we're up to 50 countries now, that provide military assistance to Ukraine. And it's been widely rumored that this is an attempt by Secretary General Stoltenberg and others in the alliance to so-called Trump-proof the alliance. But again, for reasons I noted earlier, that the NATO military architecture relies heavily on U.S. personnel and capabilities, I'm not sure that bringing it under the Supreme Allied Commander and into the NATO military structure, that would have that intended, if that is indeed the desire, of Trump-proofing it, since it would still be largely in U.S. hands, albeit under the guise of NATO.
And how does this move square with NATO's focus on remaining outside of this conflict to the extent that it can?
I think it's tricky. And that's why I think, as we heard at the Georgetown conference earlier this week, Saker Cavoli is committed to taking the time it takes, regardless if that means a decision comes after the July Washington summit, to investigate all of the possible scenarios that could stem from this really significant change in NATO policy. Precisely because NATO is a defensive alliance, right? This raises, I think, some thorny questions about the role that NATO could play in the future in supporting Ukraine. And not that we want to give Russia a veto, but we do want to think through possible second order and third order implications and escalation scenarios from greater direct NATO involvement in Ukraine.
Speaking of moves that some have said could escalate the war in Ukraine, there's been a lot of talk recently about bringing Ukraine into the alliance. And Ukraine has been pushing for this for some time, and certain countries in the alliance have expressed more support than others for it. Could you explain where we are in that process, both alliance-wide and from the perspective of the U.S.?
Sure. So this question of NATO membership for Ukraine really goes back to 2008, when the Bush administration was very keen to bring not just Ukraine, but also Georgia into the alliance. Ultimately, European allies blocked that. And so what you ended up with is what some analysts have called the worst of all possible worlds, which is the statement that says NATO will eventually become and welcome Ukraine, become Ukraine's home and Georgia's home, but we don't know when, in a nutshell. At the Vilnius summit last year, you saw a big public relations push, not just from the Zelensky government, but also some think tanks in Washington and European governments as well, making the case that now was the time to formally extend an invitation to Ukraine. The alliance, as we know, did not do so. What it did instead was do away with the membership action plan, the MAP, which is the typical pathway by which allies are invited to accede to the alliance. And the allies also created the NATO-Ukrainian Council, which has already met on several occasions. So what I expect to happen at Washington at the July summit is some more wordsmithing of the language, some fine-tuning of the language. But at this point, I think it's probably unlikely that the alliance will offer a formal invitation to Ukraine, despite the fact that there are those in the alliance who wish it. The Biden administration has gone on record saying it does not support membership for Ukraine at this moment in time. And I think from a practical point of view, that probably is the soundest strategy, because were Ukraine to join while there is a hot war, then from day one, NATO would be in a war, right? And if our goal is to keep NATO a defensive alliance and focused on deterrence and defense than bringing in a country that is currently at war would change that for the alliance. And so as I see it right now, I don't expect a formal invitation to be issued in July. What I expect instead is some more wordsmithing and some other carrots to Ukraine.
If we assume that bringing Ukraine into the alliance during the war is not prudent, which seems to be the U.S. position and your position, what is the purpose of these statements that are expressing significant levels of support for eventual accession of Ukraine into NATO?
Well, the purpose is to reaffirm NATO's longstanding policy that it has an open door, right? This is a membership association where those who wish to join can join. And that once conditions on the ground make it possible, then yes, Ukraine's home should be in NATO. But the conditions just aren't right now in the middle of a hot war.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web. And in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you.
constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
Okay, I'd like to turn to China now, which is an issue that NATO has been increasingly focusing on in recent years. So the most recent NATO strategic concept includes some forceful language regarding China's threat to the rules-based international order. So what is NATO's current involvement with the U.S. strategic competition with China? And how does the alliance view China's partnership with Russia, with the caveat that the alliance obviously is not monolithic in this or other issues?
Right. Great question. Here again, I think it's worth providing some context for your listeners regarding the evolution of NATO's messaging on China, because I think it's often forgotten today, in 2024 at least, that the first official mention of China in a NATO communique was actually in 2019 at the London summit. It wasn't technically a summit, but it was a London gathering of heads of state and government. Fast forward to the 2022 Madrid summit, where the new strategic concept was released, and it states, as you referenced, that the PRC not only presents systemic challenges, but that it is directly challenging NATO interests, security, and values. And that's quite a remarkable shift in a number of years, 3 years' time, really, especially for an alliance as large as NATO. But as you noted, the alliance views are by no means uniform in this regard. And I would say that I think the U.S. has done a pretty poor job of explaining to Europeans what it is looking for them in the Indo-Pacific. And I say that partly because one of the first questions I typically get asked by visiting European delegations in town is, what is it the U.S. expects of us from the Indo-Pacific? And I kind of wonder why someone in the U.S. government isn't having that explicit conversation with NATO allies, since I keep getting asked the question. There are certainly countries, the UK, France, for example, who have national military assets. They can contribute to phone ops. Germany also sent a frigate in the past, but this isn't really where Washington's main focus is when it comes to NATO and the Indo-Pacific. So I think the economic, the diplomatic leverage is what the Biden administration is looking for, and also the understanding on the part of European allies that if there is a crisis in the Indo-Pacific that the U.S. needs to become involved in, that draws the U.S. in, then the European allies will have to step up and so-called take care of Europe more than they have thus far done, that the U.S. won't be able to handle both. So again, that's not to say that Washington's asks in this regard of NATO allies won't change in time, but that's what I think the Biden administration certainly has in mind right now. Having said that, it could certainly do a better job of communicating that message directly to NATO allies, I think.
And do you have a sense, so as you've laid out, there are these competing arguments as to whether it's more beneficial for the U.S. and the Indo-Pacific if Europe can kind of handle Europe and allow the U.S. to turn toward China, or if the European allies should assist the U.S. more directly in the Indo-Pacific. So do you have a sense of which of those two paths the Biden administration feels would be preferable for the U.S. strategically?
I think at this juncture, probably the former, right? Just because, and this brings us back to our earlier discussion about the transformation underway in the NATO military commands, the integrated military command structures, but also the transformation we're starting to see in several European allies' armed force postures, right? That from a capability point of view, the European allies aren't in a position to contribute much to the Indo-Pacific.
Understanding that there are a diversity of interests among the U.S., European allies in the Indo-Pacific, what are the independent interests that the U.S.'s European allies have apart from what the U.S. wants in the Indo-Pacific?
Well, there are historical linkages, right, certainly for France and the U.K., but there are also strong economic ties. And I think it also speaks and connects back to this question of the rules-based order, right? If you have actors who, regardless of where they are located, are jeopardizing that order, then some would argue that NATO should take a position on that. And if you look at the preamble of the Washington Treaty, right, the language is quite clear, and this is why the alliance is often called a political and military alliance, right? Because it is meant to uphold the principles of the rule of law and support for democracy.
As NATO returns to its core mission, as you explained, of collective defense, where does terrorism fit into its 360-degree view, as NATO often puts it? Where is NATO's focus right now with respect to terrorism?
So I want to acknowledge that officially, right, the alliance in the 2022 Madrid strategic concept identified terrorism as the main asymmetric threat facing the alliance today. But it's quite clear when you look at everything that NATO is doing or has done in the last couple of years that the alliance is focused on the Russian Federation, which it calls the most significant and direct threat to ally security. So you do get a sense when you look at the record from the past couple of years, at least, that terrorism is a secondary concern, that it was maybe added to placate some members of the alliance, right? The so-called southern flank of the alliance, who for years argued that the Easterners were getting too many resources. And we have to acknowledge the reality of geography, right? The threat matrix looks different for Athens, Madrid, and Rome than it does for Tallinn, Riga, and Vilnius. That's just geographic fact. So NATO's southern flank has a very different set of dangers. They're worried about transnational threats such as terrorism, but also drug gangs, human traffickers, and so on. So I think the focus has, and NATO would acknowledge this, been on the Russian Federation the last couple of years. It will continue to be on the Russian Federation because it is the most significant direct threat to ally security. But I think there's growing awareness within the alliance that for political cohesion, you need to recognize that different countries have different threats. And so what that has led the Secretary General to do in recent years is to convene an expert group to examine NATO's approach to its southern neighborhood, particularly the MENA and Sahel regions. And this group came back in the fall of 2023 with its report, with a recommendation that the alliance adopt a so-called southern flank strategy, which is what the leaders will be doing at the Washington summit in July. So there will be some deliverables in terms of the southern flank, but in terms of sheer focus where the alliance will be putting most of its resources and attention for the long term, I think it's fair to say this will be on Russia.
Turning to the issue of arms control. So arms control has always been one of the relatively core aims of NATO, as I understand it. But how does NATO balance its commitment to arms control with its commitment to remaining a strong nuclear alliance?
Right. So officially, the alliance has stated that as long as nuclear weapons exist, it will remain a nuclear alliance. That's very clear. And all of the members agree to that, including Sweden and Finland, the latest two members to join. But you're right that historically, and the way this was done during the Cold War was the so-called dual track decision, right? The alliance has balanced the introduction of new nuclear weapons in Europe with emphasis on arms control. The reality, unfortunately, is that at the moment that the alliance faces a situation in which it doesn't have a willing partner for arms control, right? And so this leaves the alliance with the challenge of trying to maintain true to that vision of arms control when, you know, you need two to tango, so to speak, at the same time where we have observed a marked increase in so-called nuclear saber rattling by Putin and Medvedev and others in the regime. And there are reports that Russian nuclear weapons have been moved to Belarus. So certainly in terms of rhetoric, there's been a lot of escalation dynamics. So it's a real challenge for the alliance. And I would say that as with the standardization interoperability challenges, they're aware of it. They're trying to think through how to address this in light of the current environment and the fact that the alliance to date has been largely focused on reforms to its conventional posture. But I think this is where the alliance is turning next to look about, to look at how Russia's war in Ukraine and everything that follows from that poses new challenges for NATO as a nuclear alliance.
And what do you see as the future of nuclear deterrence in the alliance? Some have pushed for the expansion of the nuclear arsenals or the advancement of the nuclear arsenals of the UK and France to better cover NATO partners. Others have pushed for the development of the U.S. arsenal to better cover their European partners. What do you view as the likely course of nuclear deterrence within the alliance?
Prediction is a dangerous game. But you're absolutely right that this is a very much real-time debate happening. This spring we saw a really, really active debate in Germany as well about whether it should consider adopting nuclear weapons in its own posture, right? I think that's probably a bridge too far. I don't think Germany's ready to go there. But just the mere fact that they were having the debate speaks volumes about how far the European, and in this case, German mindset has shifted in the 2 years since the war began. I know the British are reforming, modernizing their nuclear deterrent, as is, of course, the US. But I think at the end of the day, right, the main strategic deterrent is the United States. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Turning to the issue of burden sharing, which has been in the news recently, especially following former President Trump's recent comment about the 2% threshold. So how relevant is this threshold anymore? We had a panelist at the conference at Georgetown make the point that it may not be such a salient marker anymore, because it may be insufficient to achieve many of the modernization aims that now seem to be militarily necessary within the alliance. So how is the alliance thinking about this 2% threshold at this point?
Well, it's definitely a moving target, right? Last year at the Vilnius summit, the allies came out and acknowledged that henceforth the defense investment pledge, the Wales investment pledge from 2014 that asked allies to contribute 2% of their GDP towards defense spending is now a floor, not a ceiling, right? And we are going to see by June of this year, 20 of the 32 allies having met that 2% target. Is it enough? No. And as is often raised in these discussions, what matters almost as much as how much you are contributing is what you are contributing to, right? So that it's not just going to retirement plans and barracks, but that it's going to real assets and capabilities. So certainly it is welcome
that we now have a majority of allies contributing and honoring their pledges, but it's not enough. And certainly given that, as we've been discussing, NATO has these very ambitious transformation plans underway, more will be needed. I think for better or worse, probably worse, the 2% language is here to stay. President Trump made it a bumper sticker issue. And so the average American may not know much about NATO, but they've heard this idea of 2%. So European politicians and Canada as well. And here I should note that Canada is one of the allies, unfortunately, that has made it quite clear that it has no ambitions to reach 2%, having just announced this week that it will stay at 1.7, I think, percent through the end of the decade, right? So there's a lot of room for improvement. This issue of burden sharing is not going to go away, but we should be focusing much more on other metrics, I think, on outputs rather than inputs. And yes, I'll leave it there.
I've heard some discussion recently about the exact obligations that Article 5 imposes on NATO countries if there were to be a direct attack on a member. Could you describe what it requires of NATO members and kind of what the range of possibilities would likely be if a NATO member were attacked?
Sure. So we can actually look to history because Article 5 has been invoked on one occasion previously in 2001, following the attack by Al-Qaeda on the United States, in which, depending on who you listen to, either the Dutch or the Canadians raised the prospect of invoking Article 5 in the NAC, the North Atlantic Council, which is NATO's chief political body. And since NATO is a consensus organization, invoking Article 5 would require consensus on the part of all now 32 allies. Once Article 5 is invoked by the NAC, then in terms of next steps, it is true that the language of the article makes clear that it is up to the respective capitals to take such action as they deem necessary, right? So it'll be a conditions contingent-based scenario, what each capital decides to contribute depending on what has happened. But I think Article 5 has held up well, right? Again, it was invoked precisely once, and that was on behalf of the United States. And so I have a lot of faith in Article 5.
The strategic concept says that certain cyber operations against a member state could trigger Article 5 obligations in particular contexts. Do you have a sense of what the extent of those operations might need to be in order to trigger Article 5?
No, and I've argued before that that's a problem, and let me explain why by stepping back first to explain some of the background context for this. So at the Wales Summit, very, very eventful summit that NATO leaders had in 2014, which coincidentally took place following another Russia-Ukraine crisis, the alliance for the first time stated that Article 5 extended to cyberspace. So in 2022, following on the heels of the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg confirmed that NATO's policy regarding collective defense and cyberspace held strong. And he noted specifically that he wanted to make clear to Russia that a cyber attack could trigger Article 5. Now, despite that rhetoric, and this speaks directly to your question, Matt, exactly how and when Article 5 would apply to cyberspace remains unclear. And some have argued, and at the nuclear level, I think this is true, strategic ambiguity in this regard is generally seen as a good thing. But at the cyber level, I'm not so sure because there's a whole range of activities that are happening in cyberspace, which to my mind do not rise to the level of necessitating an Article 5 response. So the way I like to look at Article 5 is that I think it should be reserved exclusively for armed attacks. And when it comes to cyber, there's an open question as to the threshold that could trigger a response. There's also the challenge that we were just discussing about individual countries deciding to contribute such actions as they're taking such actions as they deem necessary, right? And I think getting consensus on a cyber attack would probably, depending on the nature of the cyber attack, would probably be harder than getting consensus on an armed attack, conventional or nuclear.
Turning to the most recent expansion of the alliance, what do you see as the effects of Finland and Sweden joining NATO?
Sure. So before addressing what the two newest allies bring to the table, which is quite a lot, I just want to underscore what a remarkable and historical development this is. Sweden basically overnight overturned two centuries of non-alignment policy. And Finland, too, had a longstanding national policy of wanting to remain outside of great power conflicts. So in strategic terms, the map of Europe has undergone an incredible change in the last 2 years. And some have said that with the accession of these two Nordic countries, the Baltic Sea is now a NATO lake. I wouldn't quite go that far myself because the Russian Navy retains the ability to operate in the Baltic Sea, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. But it is true that the inclusion of these two countries will undoubtedly make significant contributions to the alliance's military capabilities. So if you're the Baltics, Sweden and Finnish accession adds strategic depth, right? The geography of the Baltics is such that it makes their defense very challenging for the alliance. And the addition of Sweden and especially Finland allow you now to pre-position more equipment and potentially forces as well in the area. Apart from that, these two countries also bring really strong military capabilities. And more importantly, the kind of military capabilities that many allies lack right now. It's exactly because these countries had a long tradition of non-alignment and so therefore had to rely on themselves for defense that they have really strong territorial forces. So Sweden has a great navy. The Finns have a great territorial defense force. They have a reserve that's something like 800,000 strong because of universal conscription. So that's a big, big plus. There's also an opportunity with Sweden and Finland joining Norway and Denmark in the alliance to further streamline regional Nordic defense cooperation and information sharing within the alliance. So last year, all of the Nordic CHODs, the chiefs of defense, came out and announced that they were creating a joint Nordic air force that will stand up later this decade and count 250 strong. Right. So it allows you, the addition of Sweden and Finland allows you to combine national capabilities now in a way that wasn't always possible before when Sweden and Finland, despite being NATO partners, were nevertheless outside of the alliance. A couple other points I would just note quickly. Sweden has a very strong defense industry at a time when Europe is looking for ways to get back into the defense industrial game and produce more arms and ammunition. That's a plus. Sweden and Finland are very good at national resilience and civil preparedness, the kinds of things that Article 3 of the Washington Treaty talks about that are increasingly getting more attention within the alliance. And switching the political side of the house, these are two very healthy, very robust democracies at a time when several allies are experiencing democratic backsliding. So it's also an opportunity to remind everyone inside the alliance of what is written in the preamble of the Washington Treaty, that NATO is founded on the principles of democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. So the addition of Sweden and Finland will undoubtedly contribute a lot to the alliance, better information sharing, military capability, strategic depth. Their inclusion, however, will also require a fair share of resources on the part of other allies. These are two very large countries whose defense now falls under the collective responsibility of the other allies and the alliance as a whole. So that, to my mind, is likely to require the creation of new NATO installations, commands, or entities in either Sweden or Finland, which will need to be staffed from within the alliance's already stretched personnel requirements. Finland just this week offered to host a new land component command for NATO's multinational force. So on the whole, I would say right now it's probably still a net gain for the alliance, but I think it's a mistake to think that it's an entirely one-sided deal. After all, Sweden and Finland wouldn't be joining unless they expected that they would get something from the alliance as well, right? That there's something to worth belonging to NATO. In the future, the balance could change, but right now it is on the whole a net gain, I think, for the alliance.
Does Finland and Sweden's induction into the alliance represent the alliance's view that expanding it is the path toward greater security?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the official position of NATO has been clear, and certainly since the 1990s, the alliance has spoken of its open door policy, that expansion for those who wish to join and are able to meet the requirements of NATO membership, both in terms of political requirements and military contributions and capabilities, then they are welcome, right? If the other allies agree and accede to ratify their accession. So the alliance has been quite consistent in this regard. And that's also what we see in its messaging towards Ukraine and Georgia in particular right now, that it is an alliance that is open for business and for future members. And I think it's important for the alliance, and this again connects back to the 1990s, to not let Russia determine what NATO does or doesn't do, right? That's been something that the alliance has been quite consistent about since the end of the Cold War, at least. There was this brief moment in the 1990s where several allies were exploring the possibility of another alternative security framework for Europe, one that could possibly include Russia. But as we know, that did not happen. And I think NATO has shown that it is committed to enlargement.
One striking comment I heard recently from a European security expert is that Europeans in the alliance believe that U.S. isolationism is here to stay, regardless of who wins the election in November. Is that your read among the US's allies in NATO? And what does that reveal about the future and staying power of the alliance?
So I don't know if it's my read among the allies. It's certainly what I've been advising the ones who ask me, though, because I think there has been a tendency, this may be changing in light of the holdup on the Hill about the Ukrainian supplemental aid bill. But I think there has been a tendency in some European capitals to think that this is a Trump problem. This is a one-man phenomenon, right? And even Trump can't live forever. And I think that's a mistake. That's short-sighted because we are witnessing a transition in U.S. politics. Again, as the congressional holdup over the Ukrainian supplemental bill illustrates. So former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, very famously during his farewell address a number of years back, tried to warn our European allies that Obama was the last, really, of a generation of leaders committed to the transatlantic relationship, this post-World War II order. And I think he got it wrong. I think Biden may be the last, but it's clear that there is an element in the GOP, as well as, I would argue, an element within the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, who has a different vision for the U.S.'s role in Europe's future, right? Some have called this isolationist, but really it's a different vision for America's role in the world and America's role in Europe in particular. So I think we are in this transformational era. We've spoken a lot about transformation today, not just within NATO as an alliance, but in U.S. politics, right? That future generations just don't remember, frankly, what NATO is and was about during the Cold War and what we see it increasingly being about again today. And so making that case for U.S. investment in Europe is going to be harder going forward, regardless of who wins the November election, I think.
Okay, we will have to leave it there. Sara, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter through our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osban of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.